welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, and electronic dance music, and now heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter, at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today, Nate welcomes back John Anderson to talk Neil Young, Stephen Stills, and the Buffalo Springfield. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to let it roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and today we're joined by John Anderson, the author of For What It's Worth, The Story of Buffalo Springfield. John, welcome back.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Nate.
I almost got your name right this time, but we're learning. Slowly but surely. So the Buffalo Springfield, this is a band that's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame that's had at least one album go platinum, although it took 25 or 30 years to do it. But in a lot of ways, this is a band that's seen as a coulda, woulda, shoulda band that didn't quite accomplish their potential. What's your take on the Buffalo Springfield?
I think the coulda, woulda, shoulda is appropriate. When they came together, they had so much potential. I mean, keep in mind when they did their first album in 66 and they recorded in, you know, late summer, early fall of 66, it was all original material. And the Byrds weren't doing all original material by then, you know, certainly contemporaries of the Buffalo Springfield. So they were well ahead of the curve of their, you know, those who were in the same kind of category as they were. Brilliant band. And I think that that has shown itself, you know, in decades later with the success of Stephen Stills and Neil Young and Richie Furay, and although briefly in the band, Jim Messina as well. Incredible talents in that band, so much potential, but plagued by so many problems, internal and external problems, it's amazing that they were able to get out the music that they did. And the original band was only together about 18 months. I mean, they had people in and out in between those times. But just the fact that they recorded three great albums, but also, you know, when the box set came out, and it had 37 tracks that no one had heard before that are all great.
Yeah, it's quite a CV, especially for such a short period of time. But what a volatile mix of personalities. And before we start on the story, I want to talk about the book a little bit, too. You co-authored it with Richie Furay. Is that the right way to say his name?
Yeah, and it's Richie Furay, and it's John. Although it seems to be always saying Anne, but it was John Anderson with Richie Furay is the original crediting on it. I felt that I needed to have someone from the band on side to make it, you know, to authenticate the story rather than just me kind of doing research from articles and things like that. And Richie is the guy that I guess has the least skin in the game in terms of ego. He, you know, I mean, Stills has his own perspective. Young has his own perspective. But Richie was the guy in the middle between them, and he doesn't have an axe to grind in any way at all. So he was a natural. Plus, I'd already connected with Richie when I did an earlier book on Neil Young's Canadian years called Don't Be Denied. So when I contacted Richie again and said, you know, let's do this, he jumped at the opportunity to do so. So he's the principal interview throughout the book, but he's not exclusively the only interview throughout the book, but he really has, I think he's got a really clear perspective on how everything went down.
Yeah. I mean, he comes across as a very level-headed, even-tempered, mm-hmm. nice guy, which is not something you can say about Stephen Stills and Neil Young.
Like, yeah, exactly. I mean, they've got their, you know, their own, as I said, axe to grind in the way they perceive things. You know, Richie had this, I remember reading early interviews back in '66 and early stories on the band in Teen Set magazine, and he was dubbed the Joe College guy, you know, so, you know, straight-laced guy, and he certainly has maintained that throughout his career.
Yeah, absolutely. And his career was pretty notable. He went on to co-found Poco with Jim Messina and quit right before they had their most mainstream success, but made several high quality albums with Poco. So pretty successful. So, you know, post Buffalo Springfield career in his own right. Although when compared with the mega success of Stephen Stills with Crosby, Stills and Nash and Neil Young, both with Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, and then solo, you know, Richie got passed by, but he certainly made a bigger impact in the music business post Buffalo Springfield than the bassist Bruce Palmer and the drummer Dewey Martin. Nonetheless, that original fivesome, even though there were nine people in the band in 18 months, there's really a core five, and they came together in a really unique way, or at least four out of the five. Can you tell the classic Hearst traffic jam meeting story?
Well, you know, it's to preface that, three of the five guys in the Buffalo Springfield were Canadians. And I'm in Canada here. I'm in Winnipeg. So me, and I'm sure for a lot of other Canadians, it was a great sense of pride that one of the most beloved bands in the United States was Three-Fifths American. But, you know, when I did the book, I knew that certainly the key moment, and it's become epic, it's become mythical, is this traffic jam meeting. And I knew that there were five principals involved with it, so I needed to get the perspective of all five. I didn't want to write it from my own perspective as if I knew what happened. I wasn't there. But these five guys were. And it's this traffic jam encounter on Sunset Boulevard on April the 6th, 1966. Neil Young had already come down to LA looking for Stephen Stills. You know, and there's lots of, you know, pre-story to all of that too, which we'll talk about later. But he was looking for Stephen Stills, and he brought Bruce Palmer, a bass player that he had been working with in the Minor Birds, with him. And the idea being to form a band with Stephen Stills. And they arrived on April 1st, which Neil said to me, he said it was rather appropriate, April Fool's Day. And they spent 6 days looking for Stills and couldn't find him. So on April the 6th, they decided, to heck with this, we're going to head for San Francisco. So they're going one way on Sunset Boulevard. And coming the other way is a white van, which belonged to Barry Friedman, who was kind of managing Stephen Stills and Richie Furay, who were together in L.A. to form a band as well. And one of them, and it's interesting that all three of them claim they were the one that spotted the hearse, because Neil loved hearses, and he was driving a 1953 Pontiac hearse with Ontario license plates, because he'd been living in Ontario then. And whichever one it was spotted the hearse and honked the horn and managed in rush hour traffic to maneuver their way behind the hearse, honking the horn. And they pulled into Ben Frank's restaurant parking lot and got out. And the only person that they didn't know was Bruce Palmer, but Neil had already met Stills. Neil had already met Furay. And they kind of embraced and, hey, it's good to see you. And they went back to Barry Friedman's house and formed the band that night. But the cincher for Neil was that a song that he'd written in the fall of 1965 called Nowadays Clancy Can't Even Sing, which in many ways was a metaphor for the fact that his career had stalled. I mean, nobody wanted to hear him as a folk singer. He couldn't get any gigs in Toronto with his band, the Squires. So it's out of frustration that he wrote this song about a classmate that he knew at Kelvin School in Winnipeg, who everybody used to pick on him. So he stopped singing. He used to sing in the halls. Everybody used to pick on him. So he stopped. And Neil sort of took that as a metaphor for, you know, I'm not getting anywhere in my career, so, you know, maybe I should stop doing this too. And he taught it to Richie Furay in the fall of 1965 on a brief weekend trip to New York. And Furay took it in February of 66 to LA to meet Stills and taught it to Stills. And the two of them worked out a version of it. So here they are together at Barry Friedman's house on Fountain Avenue in Hollywood. And Stills and Furay play Neil their arrangement of his song. So even though it took Neil, you know, a few more months to get to Hollywood, get to LA, his song arrived before he did. And he said, he knew right away, and we had to form a band together. So it's just so, so quick. And it's the stuff of myth. It's the stuff, I mean, you couldn't make a Hollywood movie like this because no one would believe it.
And let's go ahead and hear it. This is the Buffalo Springfield's first single with Richie Furay on vocals, but it's a Neil Young song. Nowadays, Clancy Can't Even Sing.
All over my face. Where's that silhouette I'm trying to trace? Who's putting sponge in the bells I once rung? And taking my gypsy before she's begun to sing it.
That was a Buffalo Springfield's debut single, Nowadays Clancy Can't Even Sing, written by Neil Young, but sung, as you said, by Richie Furay. And this is, you know, my personal experience with the Buffalo Springfield comes with my big brother having the Neil Young Decade album, and which started with several of his songs from the Buffalo Springfield. Songs I love, Mr. Soul, Burned, Old Laughing Lady, I think is on there. And then when I finally tracked down Buffalo Springfield, I got the Buffalo Springfield Again album, because that's the one the Rolling Stone Record Guide gave 5 stars. And I was the kind of drone that did what I was told by the music critics and you know, had to get the right album. And so I didn't get their first album. And it really wasn't until and over the years, I've tried to get into it. And various friends of mine who are big folk rock heads are like, oh, man, the first album is the one you got to get into. And it wasn't until I read this book and went back through that I finally got it, that I snapped to on that first album and what the original concept of the band was. The band was supposed to have Richie Furay as the lead singer, with Neil Young right. and Steve Stills as supporting songwriters and harmony singers. And it totally changed the game. And it had a, you know, most of the first album has a unified sound. And, you know, it's an adjustment, because I think Steve Stills and Neil Young both go on to really be key architects of what we think of as rock music, you know, with Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, whereas Buffalo Springfield is folk rock, or folk pop rock, really. I mean, it's right in the spirit of 1966, in this time before everything got so serious and bands were just trying to make hits. So it's you know, a total gestalt change for me on how to perceive the band. Do you see it that way as well?
Oh, exactly. You know, when you talk to, you know, Richie, and I mean, I talked to Dewey and to Bruce as well, and Neil, but certainly those three guys, they said that the best album of all was the first album, because that's the only album where we played like a band. And you notice that when you listen to Again, the second album, and you listen to Last Time Around, it's more singular vocals with maybe some harmonies. But on that first album, you've got Stills and Furay singing together quite often. And as you say, Furay is singing three of Neil Young's songs, because Neil didn't have much confidence in his voice, and yet Neil still sings 2 songs on the album as well. But there's an interesting little, if you've got the original album, I don't know, on CD or a vinyl, I think it's the same, it's got a list of little, you know, words and phrases to describe each guy, and you know, with, and it had their kind of hometowns, and for Neil it said Winnipeg, Manitoba, which made everybody here excited. But it says under Stills at the bottom, it says, Steve's the leader, but we all are. And bingo, right there from the start, there's going to be the problem. Because Steve and I always regarded it as his band, and Richie Furay had said it, Steve was the boss right from day one. It was his band. But Neil couldn't accept that, because up to that point, Neil was the boss of every band he had been in, and he didn't quite like the idea of being second fiddle to someone else. So you've got these ego problems right from the start. But, you know, that first album was brilliant because, as I said before, it was all original material from, you know, I think Neil had 5 songs and Stills had 7 songs. You know, Stills had a more commercial ear. And yeah, it's very folk influenced, but it's also got, you know, pop leanings as well. A number of those songs could have been hit singles, you know, had they been released as singles, and as well, had they been produced better. And that was another problem as well, having to do with record label and management kind of getting in the way of it all.
Yeah, and they'll do that. But let's backtrack a little bit and talk about the backgrounds of the main guys. What was Stephen Stills' background? How did he come? Like, he came out of a group called the Agogo Singers from the club Agogo in New York, along with Richie, which is pretty much a straight up Kingston Trio style, big, you know, 7, 8, 9 members, I think, all of them singing very slick, polished folk pop, early 60s style stuff, which, you know, that's kind of a forgotten era. We overwrite the Kingston Trio and Peter, Paul, and Mary and sort of ignore it and pretend it never happened. But there was, you know, some immensely popular music. And, you know, people like Stephen Stills and Richie Furay were really trying to succeed in that game. But that wasn't the whole of Steve Stills' musical background. What else was he bringing to the table?
Well, he brought a lot of different influences, a very eclectic taste that he had, because he brought in blues and rock and roll and even Latin music, because he lived for a time with his family, I think, in Nicaragua or Honduras. And so he brought those influences in there as well. You know, you mentioned about the folk era. The Go-Go Singers are kind of patterned after the New Christy Minstrels or the Serendipity Singers, which were these, you know, like you say, multi-ensemble folk groups. And there really wasn't anything that original about the Go-Go Singers. I mean, they sang all these harmonies, and they did kind of popular folk songs of the day, like Where I'm Bound and San Francisco Bay Blues and that sort of thing. But Stephen was the main guitar player in the group, and he sang on their album, High Flying Bird, which would influence Neil in his band, The Squires, to change the band's name to the High Flying Birds. But Richie was the lead singer, and he stood out and he, you know, front and center in the group. And Stephen was another voice of, you know, the seven or eight others in the group at that time, too. They all kind of shared that vocal. But yeah, Stephen was very much schooled in a lot of different influences. And what's interesting is you hear those influences on the three Buffalo Springfield albums, but certainly in his career after that. And, you know, looking at a song like Uno Mundo on the third Buffalo Springfield album, you know, it's all Latin rhythms, and Stills brought that. And a song like My Angel, which he recorded during the time of the Springfield and later recorded in one of his solo albums, very, very bluesy. So he brought that with him, and that certainly was a strength that the Buffalo Springfield had because of Stills. But then you've got Neil Young coming in, and he's a rock and roller guy with his, you know, played in the community club dances here in Winnipeg for several years. But he would also every Sunday go to the Hootenannies at a folk club in Winnipeg called the 4D or Fourth Dimension. So he kind of had one foot in each canoe here in that sense, that he loved rock and roll, but he also liked folk music. And it was the lyrics of folk music that appealed to him and the beat of rock and roll that appealed to him. So, you know, we see him putting that all together. His lyrics are deeper than Stills' lyrics, but Stills can write a commercial song more than Neil can. Okay. So, and Richie coming from that folk thing again, 1958 to 1964 was this thing called the folk boom. And you're right, it started with the Kingston Trio and Tom Dooley. And if you look on the second Buffalo Springfield album on the back, where they list all their influences, each guy, you know, got to put forth about, you know, 9 or 10 different people. And you have Richie and Stephen putting out the Kingston Trio on that list. And Neil Young putting out Ian and Sylvia because he loved Four Strong Winds. Interesting, too, that Neil Young included on that list Randy Bachman from Winnipeg, who, you know, would be in the Guess Who and later Bachman Turner Overdrive, who was a huge influence on Neil Young when he was first starting out here in Winnipeg. And Dewey coming in, Dewey Martin, having played with, you know, Farron Young and played country music. And Bruce Palmer, who played rock and rhythm and blues in Toronto with bands like The Sparrows and The Minor Birds. So quite I mean, they drew from a very diverse palette of music, the Buffalo Springfield, and you hear all of those influences in what they do.
Yeah, and the Sparrow was a band that included several people who went on to be in Steppenwolf, and the Minor Birds was fronted by Rick James and then included Bruce Palmer on bass and eventually Neil Young on lead guitar, and they even signed with Motown and made a record until Rick James' legal problems sunk them. But let's go ahead and hear the B-side of that first Buffalo Springfield single. This is a country rock flavored song written by Stephen Stills, but sung by both Stills and Furey. This is Go and Say Goodbye.
You asked me to read this letter that you wrote the night before, and you really should know better, cause she's worth a whole lot more. Brother, you know you can't run away and hide. You don't want to see her cry. Is that why you won't go and say goodbye? Then you said the fault was yours and you really were to blame.
And that was Go and Say Goodbye, written by Stephen Stills, but featuring a real heavy country sound, which was way ahead of its time in 1966. And I guess that's why the record label got cold feet and flipped it over and had Clancy as the A-side. Although Clancy's really a song I don't think that would have found a market until freeform FM radio came along just a couple years later in Northern California. So yeah, this is definitely where the fans can play the woulda, coulda, shoulda game and said, well, what if they put out this song or that song instead? of course, this is a band that's most famous for having the one big hit single, and that's For What It's Worth, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But that song's kind of atypical of this early Buffalo Springfield run. It's Steve Stills on vocals doing a very topical, though, folky lyric, and with arrangements that are a very mature rock sound. So it's kind of, you know, very much cutting edge of 1967. And I think it's telling, you know, you talk in the book how Stephen had spent time in Greenwich Village, and he wasn't just trying to be the new Christy Minstrels or the Kingston Trio. He was also meeting and playing with guys like Tim Hardin and Fred Neil and Richie Havens, people who would be kind of come along after Bob Dylan came along with the second wave of, I'm not big on the word authentic, but more authentic kind of folk or whatever, rougher, more personal, a lot more complicated lyrics. But another guy that Stephen met at the same time was Peter Tork, or Torkelson is his given name, obviously famous for being in the Monkees. Did Steve Stills really audition for the Monkees?
Yeah, he did. He auditioned for the Monkees, and he didn't get it. A couple of reasons. Now, he has always said, you know, and this is where egos get into it when people tell their own stories. He's always said that he turned them down because he wanted to write his own music, and they already had songwriters. But, you know, I talked to a few people who were friends with him at the time and knew him and also knew the guys, you know, who became the Monkees. And one of them being Nurit Wilde, who was very close to the whole scene. And she said Stills was very disappointed that they turned him down. And he carried that with him for months afterwards. And, you know, when Peter Tork became, you know, hugely successful and the Springfield weren't quite there, Stephen was very jealous of it. They turned him down for two reasons, none of which had to do with his singing or guitar playing or songwriting. It had to do with the fact that he was already losing his hair. He had a receding hairline, and he had bad teeth. If you look at early pictures of Stills, his teeth, I mean, you know, dentists and orthodontists salivate as they look at what they could do in his mouth. So they didn't want to have to deal with that, you know, in a teeny bopper group that was being put together for television. So, yeah, they turned him down. But I think in terms of quality music, creativity, and integrity, Stephen Stills beat Peter Tork, definitely. There's another guy that Stephen Stills got to know in Greenwich Village, and that's Graham Parsons. Now, Parsons was down from Harvard University. He only spent about 3 months there, and he'd moved down to New York with his ultimately with his band, the International Submarine Band. But Stephen and Graham talked about putting a band together and even had a few rehearsals before it kind of all fell apart. And even before that, when John Sebastian and Zal Yanofsky were putting together the Love and Spoonful, before Steve Boone joined, Stephen auditioned to play bass in the Love and Spoonful. So he was a guy that was really, you know, trying to make it and, you know, willing to adapt to whatever was necessary. But you named some key folk people that influenced Stills. He is a great folk finger-picking style guitar player. And he learned that in, you know, in hanging out with, you know, some of these luminaries in Greenwich Village. And he, I guess in many ways, he brought more of the folk influence to the Buffalo Springfield than any of the others. You know, Neil wrote some folk songs and dabbled in it, but Stills was steeped in it from being in Greenwich Village and hanging out with these guys more so than Richie Furay did. Now, For What It's Worth, I mean, it's iconic. I mean, it has certainly transcended the pop charts to become an anthem for the 60s. And in every movie, every documentary, even if it's commercials, you know, they tap into that song because it is so iconic and it immediately places you in 1966 or 67. Stills has told some really tall tales about how he was inspired to write it. And he, even just recently, he was in some interview somewhere saying that, yeah, I was on the front lines of that protest in, you know, in LA, and we were fighting the cops and, you know, all that. And that's nonsense because, you know, even Neil Young told me that they were in Sausalito playing at a place called the Ark when that, you know, the Sunset Strip riot took place on November the 12th, 1966. And they all watched it on a television in their motel room. And it inspired Stephen when he got back to LA to write that song For What It's Worth. But he captured the zeitgeist of the times. And what's interesting too is that they'd only, the last sessions for the debut album were only about 6 weeks earlier, but the maturity of their sound in going in and recording that song, for what it's worth. It's leaps and bounds above, you know, the quality of what they were recording and writing on that first album. That's not to say the first album wasn't very good, because it, writing-wise, it's brilliant. Production-wise, it's lousy. But for what it's worth, is a huge leap forward for them.
Yeah, and it's very frustrating they didn't really get put right into the studio and get to work on a second album. They cut a bunch of tracks around that time, but for various reasons, you know, that didn't come together. And when the second album was recorded, most of that stuff they recorded in that period was kind of pushed aside. But yeah, it's a major leap forward. And you also mentioned in the book that the band they were playing with at the Arc in Sausalito was Moby Grape, who's kind of their evil San Francisco twin. Evil's probably not right, but you know, another three guitar band with multiple singer songwriters and harmony vocals. And you mentioned this in the book, but Moby Grape fans will talk about it a lot more. Stephen Stills kind of swiped two different Moby Grape songs and put them together with his brilliant lyrical take to make For What It's Worth. Like they had a song called Stop, where the whole stop look, you know, I think he improved the chorus, and then he took the melody, the verse melody from Murder in My Heart for the Judge, which is probably Moby Grape's greatest song. And because of that, it didn't get put on their first album. So Moby Grape's probably the only band even more cursed than the Springfield. So,
well, you know, thank goodness for Stephen Stills, Peter Lewis from Moby Grape didn't sue him. And I think I interviewed him for the Springfield book, and he was quite magnanimous about it. He understood that these things kind of happen along the way, that people borrow from others. But even the concept of Moby Grape was based around the Springfield, because in the fall of 66, some of the guys in the Springfield hatched a plan to replace Dewey Martin. Dewey Martin was older than the other guys, and he was certainly very gregarious, boisterous, loud, and he was a heavy drinker. And it wasn't his drumming. His drumming was excellent. It was just his personality that kind of rubbed some of them the wrong way, namely Stills. So, you know, a covert audition was held with Skip Spence, who had been the drummer in the Jefferson Airplane and had left them because he didn't want to be a drummer anymore. But he auditioned for the Springfield without Dewey knowing, and, you know, was right there seeing the lineup, the, you know, the three guitar lineup. And when he went back to San Francisco with his manager, Matthew Cates, they assembled a three guitar lineup, like you say, you know, I don't want to say second rate, because that's not the case at all, but a Buffalo Springfield clone, if you will, in terms of lineup.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. I think your research has really clarified, you know, who swiped what idea from whom over that time period. But yeah, the bands were tight. They played together. They were peers at the time and really inspired each other. But let's take a quick sponsor break. And when we come back, we'll talk about what happened to the Buffalo Springfield to keep them from making it as big as they could have been.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shouted Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
And so we talked about kind of the backgrounds of at least Stephen Stills, a little bit about Neil Young. Richie Furay kind of had more of the pop folk background, but he was also into country music deeply and authentically. He was into doo-wop, and he was also into early rock and roll, especially the Everly Brothers and Buddy Holly school of rock and roll. And he had done, you know, traveled out from Ohio and done the whole Greenwich Village thing. And that's where he met up with Stephen Stills and formed the Agogo Singers. But Neil Young had a different background. I was pretty surprised to find out that he was a surf rocker before he started adding folk elements. So he was doing instrumentals. And
Yeah, and I quibble with surf, and I don't think I even use that term. And a lot of people do because they assume that if he's playing instrumentals, it must be surf instrumentals. Actually, most of the instrumentals that he played, the ones that he didn't write because he wrote lots of them, but the other ones were by The Shadows, an English band that backed up Cliff Richard, but also had instrumental hits on their own. And Neil was a huge Shadows fan and a huge Hank Marvin fan. You got to remember, in Winnipeg, Manitoba, there's no ocean to surf on, and there's certainly the waves aren't big enough on Lake Winnipeg and Lake Manitoba to go surfing. So it's not that he's playing surf music, it's that he's playing instrumental music, which I guess in 1963 kind of gets lumped into the pipeline and, you know, ventures kind of stuff.
Yeah,
but yeah, he recognized early on that the key to success was writing your own songs. So he was ahead of the curve from his musical contemporaries in Winnipeg, and he started out writing instrumental music, very melodic, and he has a very melodic style to his guitar playing before he then started singing.
Yeah, and singing was what he struggled with. He added vocals when the Beatles came out. And immediately the audience, you know, was skeptical of him as a singer. And then when he went to Toronto, and like you said, the Squires couldn't get gigs, he tried to make it in the folk scene. And this was a very bustling folk scene. Joni Mitchell was there. John Kay of Steppenwolf was doing acoustic folk in that same scene around the same time. And Neil Young had a pretty bruising experience where people didn't like his singing and didn't get what he was trying to do. So that, you know, is part of why he ends up taking Bruce Palmer's invitation to join the Minor Birds, and then ends up with Bruce coming down to California. And so there's already trouble brewing. I guess anytime you put Neil Young in a band, you've got trouble brewing.
Well, yeah, it's, I think David Crosby once said, anytime Neil walks into the room, it's his room. You know, he's like that. Just talking about the voice thing, when Neil made his first singing debut on a recording in Winnipeg in April of 1964, a song he wrote called I Wonder, at the end of the session, it was done on a little two-track recorder at a radio station in Winnipeg. At the end of the session, Neil walked up to the engineer and said, so what do you think? And the recording engineer said, you're a good guitar player, kid, but you'll never make it as a singer. So that, you know, that certainly haunted him. And people always saying, oh, Neil, you can't sing. That he had no confidence really in his voice. And as we've said, it was, you know, Richie was the guy with the best voice of the whole Buffalo Springfield band. And so it made sense for him to sing Neil's songs. But, you know, Neil has an ego. And so he wanted to make sure that he at least sang some of his songs.
Yeah, and that's the thing that really comes through. And there's a quote you got from Neil Young that you have to give him points for self-awareness and the willingness to criticize himself. He just comes out and says it. I had to shit on a lot of people and leave a lot of friends behind to get where I am now, especially in the beginning. And it seems pretty much like everybody in the Buffalo Springfield. You didn't have any quotes from Stills angrily trashing Young, but there are plenty of those from other sources. But Neil was the wild card,
perfect choice of words. He was a wild card. He was a loose cannon.
Yeah, and they get together, and Barry Friedman is somebody I think doesn't get enough credit in the story. He was the guy driving the van. He had signed deals, I believe, right, with Stephen Stills and Richie Furay to be their manager, but he's pretty quickly edged out. Why did they not stick with Barry Friedman as the manager?
Well, in come Green and Stone, you know, Brian Stone and Charlie Green. And amongst their limited roster of acts, they had signed with Sonny and Cher. So they had a higher profile. Barry Friedman, I mean, he became a clown named Fraser Mohawk. He put together Rhinoceros, which, you know, great music, but never went anywhere. He was a small-time player. And Charlie Green and Brian Stone show up in a limousine. And as Richie said, Stephen was absolutely, you know, gaga when he saw that these guys had a limousine, and he was pushing for them, for the band to sign with Green and Stone. I mean, the way Barry told it to me was he met with Green and Stone somewhere, like a restaurant or something, and I guess it was Charlie Green wrote on a napkin, you know, this is what we're going to give you to relinquish management of these guys. And it was take it or, you know, I mean, it was almost like something out of, you know, The Godfather. And so, you know, Barry realized that I can't argue. I can't fight with these guys. They're pretty big time. And so he accepted it. On the one hand, you can say that Green and Stone certainly brought a lot more publicity to the band. them, you know, hire gigs and tours, and also got them a recording contract with Atco Records, a subsidiary of Atlantic Records. But on the other hand, there's Green and Stone, who have their own egos, and they think, oh, we'll be producers. We'll produce the Buffalo Springfield. And they didn't know what they were doing in the studio. I think, as Still said, they knew less than we did in the recording studio. And so they figured they better learn how to produce themselves. So Green and Stone did a lousy job of that first album producing it. And, the bass, Bruce Palmer was a very distinctive bass player. He played in a very melodic style and a fluid style, different from most bass players who just kind of thumped on the root note of a chord. But he had a very, very distinctive style. And it's lost on that album. It just kind of goes thum, thum, thum. I mean, you really don't have the quality fidelity to hear a lot of this. And some of the background singing and things are buried on it as well. So on the one hand, Green and Stone, elevated the band almost immediately. I mean, they got them on the opening act for the Rolling Stones when the Stones played, the Hollywood Bowl. But on the other hand, they would prove to be a mistake. And several of the guys that I interviewed for the band said we would have been better off signing with Elektra Records, because Jack Holzman was very keen on signing the Buffalo Springfield. He wanted them on his label. And he just couldn't come up with the same amount of money that Atco had ponied up to sign the band.
Yeah, and he got outbid for the Moby Grape right around that same time. The Doors money hadn't really started. I guess at that point, the Doors money hadn't rolled in at all yet. The Doors hadn't put out
That's right,
album.
Yeah, they hadn't signed the Doors yet. I mean, they had Arthur Lee and Love, and they had the Paul Butterfield Blues Band. I mean, both bands, brilliant, but it wasn't like they were raking in millions of dollars from record sales.
Yeah, and Friedman had already booked them at the Troubadour where he worked, and then got them on tour with the Birds immediately, and then got them a stand at the Whiskey A Go-Go, which you describe as the peak of the band, because this is a period when Fure is front and center and they're united, and they just blew people away and kind of triggered, like you said, a major label bidding war. You had, well, Elektra wasn't a major at the time, but Elektra was interested. Atlantic was interested. Warner Brothers was interested. Dunhill, Lou Adler's band, who had the Mamas and Papas, were interested, but they went with Atco, which was an Atlantic subsidiary. And yeah, and I think another big
because problem- of a limousine, because they were starstruck. It's interesting that, they did that Birds tour, and that's the first exposure they're getting, other than they did a Monday night hoot night at the Troubadour on the 11th of April. But it was Jim Dixon and Eddie Tickner, who were managing the Birds, who wanted to sign the Springfield on the basis of Chris Hillman, who had seen them rehearsing and thought they were a great band, and suggested that to Green and not Green and Stone to Dixon and Tickner that they put the band on their tour. And as it turned out, Dixon and Tickner didn't end up managing the band.
Yeah, and another what if there. But let's hear our next song. And this is an intriguing. This is one of those outtakes from the box set that came out in the 90s. And this is a song called Down, Down, Down. And Buffalo Springfield fans and Neil Young fans should recognize this, because it was later rewritten for a song Neil Young called Broken Arrow on the second Buffalo Springfield album. But this one, you can hear Fure and Stills both singing on this. So this is more of the unified band's take on a Neil Young song. This is Down, Down, Down. She'll be there to wave to you in the hope that you'll forgive her. She will join you there. Find out that now was the answer to answers that you And that was Down, 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 another Neil Young song sung by the Springfield collectively. And so they've got a record label. They've got management, although it's the wrong management. And it's funny, Steve Stills was so impressed by the limo, but Neil Young seems to have been freaked out by the limo, because he wrote so many songs about this experience of
limousines.
of limousines. He keeps mentioning limousines. And I think Fure is in the one in the book that, kind of says, I think we weren't in that many limos.
Well, you know, the thing too about Green and Stone, they won Neil over, you know, initially because they rented cars for all the guys. So they rented a Corvette for Neil. So here's Neil driving around in a car he doesn't have to pay for. So that pretty much impressed him. Plus the fact that Green and Stone got them credit at a music store in town so they could then get Fender Showman and Fender Twin Amps. And Neil had traded in his beloved Gretsch guitar, you know, when he moved to Toronto in 65. So he went out first thing and bought another orange Gretsch 6120 guitar. So, you know, Green and Stone really kind of flashed the money, and not just still, but the others also jumped at it as well. You know, one thing I want to say about Down, 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 what amazes me is that song is so fabulous. That here was a band who had stuff that they didn't even have the ability to put on. They chose not to put it on that first album. You know, I mean, that speaks to the quality of the music that they had and that they were writing and rehearsing. And you get that same thing through that period of, you know, from like January of 67 until the second album comes out like in November of 67. So many tracks, many of them show up on the box set that they recorded that were fabulous that didn't make it. Just for whatever reason, bad timing, they didn't have an album, you know, to do or whatever. So these guys were writing all the time.
Yeah, and I think one of the key things, or maybe a possible explanation for why the material was, so much material was left in the vaults and why the second album was so disjunct, you know, wasn't a coherent whole, was that Green and Stone were the kind of guys who whispered in everybody's ear rather than, you know, there's certain kind of band managers. I view Brian Epstein of the Beatles. Obviously, he made some mistakes around merchandising and song publishing, but he had a vision for what the band was, and he saw himself as a lever in the middle that balanced out John and Paul and made sure that George and Ringo got their shine as well and kept the band focused, you know, and navigated them through things like Paul McCartney's Yesterday and didn't release it as a single in England and things like that to keep the balance of the band, whereas Green and Stone didn't have that kind of sophistication. And when you're dealing with egos like Stills and Young, any hint of "Baby, You're the Star" is going to go way further.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about, you know, Brian Epstein is a perfect example. He represented and he understood the whole rather than the individual parts. But I mean, even in the Byrds, I mean, Gene Clark, they were people whispering in his ear, "You're the guy, you're the guy, you write the songs, you know, you're bigger than them." And then when Gene left for a solo career, those voices are in David Crosby's ear saying, "You're better than they are, you're better than they are," that sort of thing. So it takes certainly away from the cohesiveness of it. And yeah, they were, you know, Stills was hearing these voices and Young was hearing these voices, and Young was hearing it from Jack Nitzsche, who had certainly a lot of, you know, pedigree behind him, having crafted the Wall of Sound for Phil Spector. And he's in Neil's ear saying, "Oh, you're better. You can do better records than them," that sort of thing. But you're right. Green and Stone didn't push a cohesive unit.
And in addition to ego problems, the other thing that really dogged the band was Bruce Palmer's drug habits, especially his habit of getting arrested for drugs. What was the deal there?
Yeah, Bruce liked his LSD, and he got busted at a couple of critical points in the band's momentum, and really hurt them. I mean, here's for what it's worth, you know, rising up the charts, it got to number seven, and it's the song everybody remembers of, you know, from the band. But he got busted in New York, and both he and Neil were in the States, you know, illegally to work. I mean, you could go to the States as a Canadian, but to work you needed work permits, and so he was deported. And that period of instability from, you know, mid-January pretty much until June or the end of May when Bruce comes back and then Neil leaves really hurt them, because they should have had an album out. I mean, with For What It's Worth being, you know, a hit, they should have been putting out a second album. And even Atco Records pressed a cover and gave it the name Stampede, and we're hoping that the band would then submit tracks to go with that album, but they just weren't in no position to be able to get it together to be able to do that. And then again, Bruce gets busted, virtually a year later, January of 68, but this time in California, and again, they send him back to Canada. He had snuck across the border in May of 67 and played with the band, then he got busted and was gone, and that's when Jimmy Messina joined the band. But all at critical points, you know, in the band's, you know, progress, And at that point, I mean, and Neil had quit the band, you know, three times. So at that point, they just kind of, you know, spring of 68 said, you know, to hell with this. You know, we just can't keep doing this over and over again, starting up all over again. So it's those kind of problems, and it's, you know, record label problems, because they argued over what would be the follow-up to For What It's Worth. And, you know, Neil wanted Mr. Soul, because he wanted the A-side. Stephen had the A-side for What It's Worth. But in the record label's eyes, Stephen is now the voice of the band because he got the hit. And for an awful lot of radio listeners, they'd not heard anything by the Buffalo Springfield until For What It's Worth, and, oh, that's the singer in the band. So to throw Mr. Soul out as a single with a new voice and an odd voice to, you know, to begin with as well, you know, Ahmet Erdogan and Atlantic Records, which owned Atco, said, no, I mean, we're not going to put Neil as the A-side on this. He can be in the B-side. And that really ticked Neil off, because as you and I have been talking about throughout this, there was a lot of competition between Stills and Young. And, you know, it's like one would get the A-side, one would get the B-side kind of thing. And now, because Stills had the A-side for What It's Worth and Neil had the B-side of that, do I have to come right out and say it? Neil wanted the A-side. And in the end, the record label said, no, we're putting Bluebird, an edited version of it, on the A side, of Mr. Soul on the B side, you know, and you know, and soon after that, Neil kind of took his football and went home.
Yeah, and one thing we haven't mentioned is Neil Young started having epileptic seizures around this time, and this is really, I guess he'd had a couple before the band, if that's right, but. And he really did.
Yeah, in Winnipeg, he'd had some seizures in Winnipeg. I don't know about this time in Toronto, but he'd had seizures in Winnipeg and was diagnosed.
But it's this period of his life when the seizures are at their worst. It's not something you hear about so much later on during his career. It reminds me of, you know, the tragic story of Ian Curtis of Joy Division later on, who's plagued with seizures as the band becomes more successful and ultimately kills himself on the eve of their American tour in 1979. And Neil, I think this one thing about this book that's different from other accounts I've read, mostly about Steve, you know, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, other books about them, is that the nature of Stephen Stills' personality doesn't quite come through in this book. Did you take it easy on Stills? Because so many people talk about him as this sort of, you know, went to military school and tried to bark his orders and boss everybody around. And, uh-oh, Steph's telling me I've got to play my next song before we come back. But let's hear Stephen Stills' Rock and Roll Woman. This is from their second album, Buffalo Springfield Again. That was Stephen Stills singing lead on Rock and Roll Woman. And I was wondering if the book kind of goes easy on Stephen and is harder on Neil, because that's the way Richie felt, that he didn't really mind Steve's dominant personality and aggression, but he did mind Neil Young's flakiness.
Yeah, the thing about Neil Young is, if you bark orders at him, he's just going to walk away. He doesn't argue, he doesn't fight back, he just simply writes you off. I mean, if you don't see it his way, you're just not in his world anymore. You know, and he moves on. And Stephen was a much more aggressive personality, and Neil, being aggressive, maybe even passive aggressive, he just rebels against it. And that's why he was quitting the band, you know, ultimately three times, because he couldn't see himself as second fiddle. And Stephen Stills was not going to be anybody's second fiddle, because it was his band. And all he had to do was point to, you know, a gold record on the wall that said, For What It's Worth, you know, written by Stephen Stills. You know, you want to argue with me? Look at that. You know, this is our only hit, guys, and it's me. So, yeah, there was that certainly a divergent personalities that existed there. Did I go light on Stephen? Well, here's the thing. I interviewed Dewey, I interviewed Bruce, I interviewed Neil, I interviewed Richie. I couldn't get to Stephen Stills. So any quotes from Stephen Stills were from existing interviews that had been done. So it wasn't a conscious effort to go light on him. I think there are some people who are pretty hard on him in the book, but I just didn't have his voice. And sometimes you just have to realize when you're doing these kind of books that, you know, there are a few people who are not going to agree to be interviewed, who are above that sort of thing. And so Stills was one of those guys I just couldn't get to. But the thing is, too, on the book that kind of had preceded it, although I'd done a couple of books in between, but the book that sort of set up my Buffalo Springfield book was my Neil Young book. And it was Neil Young, the struggling kid with the Gretsch guitar here in Winnipeg, playing, writing songs, and trying to make it and leaving friends behind and all that sort of thing. It was his way or the highway. Goes to Toronto, goes to Thunder Bay, and nothing happened. Goes to Toronto, nothing happened. Goes to LA, and all of a sudden things start happening. He's an underdog, and he's an underdog that you root for. He becomes a very sympathetic character in that book, and it's not for anything that I directed in that first book, but it's really that's what he was like. But he gets success with the Buffalo Springfield, and all of a sudden it's a different Neil Young. It's he wants everything his way, and he doesn't want to be second fiddle to anybody else. All of that then happens. So you have a marked contrast between the Neil Young of my Don't Be Denied book and the Neil Young of my Buffalo Springfield book, because that's what happened. I mean, he now had success and in a moderate way. They certainly didn't have financial success at all, but they've got some notoriety and acclaim, and they're cocks of the walk on the Sunset Boulevard and the Strip and all those clubs. Not necessarily everywhere else, but it was a change in his personality. Stills too, and there are people who I interviewed who knew Stills all around that time who said that once the success came, it was validation to him that he was talented. He was creative. He was good at what he did. And so that exacerbated those kind of ego feelings as well.
And let's talk about some of the particular events that Neil Young flaked out on. There's two in particular, the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson and the Monterey Pop Festival. How on earth do you drop out of those kind of gigs?
Well, the Tonight Show was kind of a comfortable guise for him. He had already decided to leave the band after they'd made the decision to relegate Mr. Soul to a B-side. And he'd already started recording without the other guys in the band. And you have an example of that being Down to the Wire, which was on that triple decade Neil Young album, and a different version coming out on the Buffalo Springfield box set album. I mean, he's recording largely on his own, and he starts working with Jack Nitzsche, and Jack Nitzsche is saying to him, we can make better records. We can do better than you're doing with the Buffalo Springfield. So it was at a convenient point to be able to say, I just don't want to be in TV and quit the band. But it was precipitated by a number of issues and people whispering in his ear, and he just decided this was the point I'm going to leave the band. And it just so happened that Monterey happened about 2 weeks after or 3 weeks after he left the band. What always I guess kind of annoys me is when I read somewhere someone's talking about Monterey or talking about the Springfield or David Crosby saying David Crosby replaced Neil Young at Monterey. No, he didn't. Doug Hastings replaced Neil Young, and he was hired within a few days of Neil leaving as the lead guitar player in the band. Now, Doug couldn't sing and couldn't write, so that kind of limited the band that way. And when it came to Monterey, Richie Furay had tonsillitis. He had his tonsils out, after Monterey, but he wasn't singing as well, as strong, and they lacked, Neil used to sing, background vocals, and they lacked that as well. So that's why they asked Crosby to help them out vocally, but not guitar-wise. And, Bruce Palmer and Dewey Martin, both guys have passed away now, but they were both incensed that, what the hell was David Crosby doing there? So Stephen made that decision. Maybe he consulted Richie, but they didn't know anything about it until, there's David Crosby rehearsing with them, and then he's playing with them on stage. Neil left the band again in early 1968, and then when they announced they were going to be touring with the Beach Boys, he came back. And actually had photos taken, publicity photos of the four of them together. And then Neil comes back, so they got to get the picture of the five of them. And then the band gets busted, and Neil and Richie and Messina get arrested, and Stills escapes through the window and all that. So Neil says, "That's it, I'm done. I'm quitting the band again after the Beach Boys tour." So Richie really kind of summed it all up in the book when he said, "We all sort of knew that Neil was always looking for a solo career. And the band was kind of his safety net."
Yeah, and it was a frayed safety net, and plenty of opportunities to fall through the cracks. And that, to me, it was kind of poignant that last, and it was a party that Eric Clapton was at, and Eric Clapton actually got arrested too. And at the time, you know, he was still in Cream, I believe, and, you know, one of the biggest superstars in rock music. And that was just kind of the last bit of bad mojo to hit the band. And it wasn't a serious bust. And there was one more question I wanted to ask about Bruce Palmer as well. His busts are all for marijuana possession, but was his drug habit and his status worse than that? I mean, was it a case of he just had too much pot on him, or, you know, had bad luck or was set up or whatever? Or did he really have a serious substance problem in this period?
Oh, he had a serious substance abuse problem. And, you know, he smoked marijuana every day and he took LSD probably every other day. And it was just part of his personality and part of who he was. Oh, he's cool. He's zen. Ooh, he's spaced out. That kind of thing. You know, wasted man in Hollywood sort of an imagery. But he had a lot of drug issues. I mean, none of the guys in that band were choir boys. I mean, and Dewey drank a lot. He maybe smoked some pot. But, you know, the other guys in the band had all, you know, were all, you know, experienced pot smokers. And, you know, Neil never took LSD because of his epilepsy. But, you know, they weren't novices in terms of drug abuse. You know, we talked earlier about Neil's epilepsy. One of the reasons why it became more predominant during the Springfield time was the fact that they often played with light shows. And strobe lights, I mean, it even if you look it up, epilepsy can be triggered by strobe lights. And so Richie said that they would always tell a promoter before going on stage, do not use strobe lights. And either they would forget or they thought, oh, we really care, it's really cool. And then it would trigger a seizure. And Richie said he got very adept, meaning Richie, at being able to grab Neil's guitar and hold onto it while Neil hit the floor. And it's interesting, too, that I have, you know, recollections from people who saw the shows who thought this was a part of the act. Oh, we're going to go to the show tonight and see the guitar player have an epileptic fit, you know, that kind of thing. So, again, that compounds a lot of the problems. And we're sort of working our way, you and I, in discussing this, working our way towards the second album, Buffalo Springfield Again, which should have been done 6 months earlier. But in marked contrast to the first album, Buffalo Springfield Again is like three individual artists doing their own songs. And in fact, it was kind of like that. Not all of the songs have all the members of the band on them, on tracks there. And you have the singular voices rather than the doubled voices or the harmony voices, you know, doing unison lead singing together. It's Still songs. It's Neil's songs. It's Richie's songs. Dewey has a song in there too. But it showed the fragmentation, and it showed how each of them was moving apart from the others.
Yeah, it's a great album, but it's kind of analogous to the Beatles' White Album in that you've got multiple solo artists working on their own track, which for a band's second album, it just speaks to there's a lot more work they could have done together before they reached that point. And then the third album is basically Richie and then Jim Messina, the new bass player who's brought in, are stuck with a contractual obligation and a couple of tracks from Steven and a couple of tracks from Neil, and they have to put the whole third album together. How did that play out?
Well, I interviewed Messina in detail about this because I did a big article, and I think it was like Goldmine magazine, about that album. And he said, you know, it got to the point where Stills was already hanging out with Crosby and looking towards a solo career. Neil was already looking towards a solo career as well. So they weren't interested, except that Stills was still putting out quality tracks. Neil gave them I Am a Child, which he had recorded largely on his own. And where Stills was still committed, and the tracks that Stills puts on that album are really great tracks. But yeah, it was left to Messina and Fiore. And even though it often says, you know, Richie did most of the work on that, that's not true. Messina did. And Ahmet Ergen went to him and said, you always want an album. These guys aren't going to do anything about it. You have a mountain of stuff you've already recorded. I trust you, Jimmy, to put this all together. And so Jimmy with Richie did that. And Neil hated the album, and he's never said a good word about it ever, including omitting some of the tracks on that album on his on the Buffalo Springfield box set. But according to Messina, Stills was still up there and pitching, although not using all the members of the Buffalo Springfield. He was hanging out with Buddy Miles. So Buddy Miles is on the album and David Crosby's on the album. You know, those sorts of you know, hanging with the stars, I guess. I like Last Time Around a lot. And it wasn't that it had to grow on me, because sometimes albums have to grow on people. I liked it right from the get-go. I thought it was a great, great album. And as I point out, I think in the book, reviews of the album were sterling. I mean, people loved the album, but you know, Neil Young didn't like the album. I think it was what Messina and Fury did was take whatever they could salvage, and some, you know, a couple of tracks date back a year, and some new recordings, and make a very credible final statement of the Buffalo Springfield.
Yeah, it's definitely an album that holds up, and it's kind of a preview of coming attractions for what they were going to go on together and do with Poco. And with Stephen's songs being a kind of a preview of what he's about to go ahead and do with Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and Neil's songs a preview of his career before he manages to weasel his way into Crosby, Stills, and Nash, which, given the history of Springfield, it's just amazing that Stephen agreed to that. But that's a whole different story. And I talked to Peter Doggett about that previously. But one other character that I haven't brought up that I want to mention is this guy, Dickie Davis, who was kind of the road manager. He'd been involved with Barry Friedman early on and was part of the team that he kind of helped bring in Green and Stone. But he ends up being Poco's manager. And there's this complicated record label trading at the end of the band. Like, how does Poco end up on Epic? How does Crosby, Stills, and Nash end up on Atlantic, and Neil Young end up on Reprise?
Well, you know, being from Canada where hockey reigns supreme, it was like a hockey trade. You know, one guy for one guy from team to team. In order to free up Graham Nash, they had to get him, you know, off of Epic. And so David Geffen actually did the legwork to arrange that kind of a swap to get Nash free, because Nash's membership in Crosby, Stills, and Nash was more important at that point than Richie's presence with Poco on Epic Records. So it was driven by the need to get Nash free. And, oh yeah, okay, well, we'll put Richie over here with his band, Poco, and sign that. It was very unique for its time. You didn't hear that kind of thing going on of swapping players by record labels. But clearly, Atlantic Records saw the future and the money in getting Nash in with Crosby and Stills than they did with Richie Furay and his, you know, little country band, Poco.
Which I think had more commercial prospects than it. I mean, in retrospect, it's seen as too soon. It was country rock ahead of its time. But apparently Dickie Davis made some mistakes as manager around the cover art of the first album that caused Epic to not push Poco. So there's another coulda, woulda, shoulda. And before I let you go, I want to ask about... Well, go ahead.
Dickie, you know, Dickie started as road manager, and then when things started falling apart and the band bought out Green and Stone, Dickie stepped in to be manager of Buffalo Springfield, and he was friends with Richie, so he became manager of Poco. But even Richie said to me, he said, Dickie was a mistake. He didn't know what he was doing as a manager. He made mistakes. He didn't do the right things to get the profile raised in the band. So, sorry, I wanted to mention that.
Yeah, that's important stuff. I just want to ask one last question. And this is a story that's not in the book that I had read elsewhere, and I just want to see if you can confirm or deny. There's a story I read that Neil Young, that at one point Geffen and Elliot Roberts, is that right, were around the band and talking about managing the band, and that Neil Young in rehearsal threw a temper tantrum and said, you know, I insist that we fire these guys. We cannot work with these guys. And then later that night shows up at Robert's house, knocking on his window and say, hey, will you manage my solo career? Do you know if anything, have you come across that particular story of Neil Young shenanigans?
I heard that they were on a bus, the band, Springfield, on a bus heading for a gig somewhere. And on the bus too was Elliot Roberts. And Neil leaned over to him on the bus and said, hey, would you, you know, I'm leaving the band. Would you manage the band? And then, you know, a day or so later, he shows up at his house and says, I've left the band. Would you manage me? That sort of thing. Neil throwing a hissy fit. I mean, it's very rare that you see any evidence of Neil throwing a hissy fit. What Neil does is he just walks away.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, so he just packs up his guitar, goodbye, doesn't say anything. I mean, Neil didn't throw fits. Stephen Stills would throw fits because he was used to being the boss man. And then you mentioned the military school training and all of that sort of thing. Neil just, okay, I'm done with this and move on. And he just kind of crosses you off his list of people that he knows anymore, that sort of thing. So I'm not sure I buy the hissy fit, but I do know that that Elliot was offered by Neil to manage the Springfield. And literally a day or so later, Neil comes to Elliot and says, you know, I'm out of the band. Would you manage me?
Looking out for number one. And so my guess
Randy Bachman may have written that song, but he could have written it for Neil Young.
Yeah. And if you ever wonder how you get to be Neil Young, you do things like that, or at least that was his path to that kind of success. So my guest today has been John Anderson, and the book is For What It's Worth, The Story of Buffalo Springfield. Thanks so much, John.
Hey, my pleasure.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Thursday, Nate welcomes Scott B. Bomar to talk about the original Byrds from 1964 to 1967. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.